Good morning, everyone, and welcome to our second panel. Please allow me to introduce myself very briefly. My name is Colin Dürkop. I'm the country representative of the Konrad Adenauer Foundation in Ankara. I did my schooling time in Istanbul, secondary through high school, and I returned to Turkey 2.5 years ago to a completely new Turkey. And it has been, in my 25 years working for the Konrad Adenauer Foundation, my most interesting but also most challenging posting. Challenging, let me just mention, the first day when I came to my office in Ankara was the day when the Turkish Prime Minister accused the German political foundations of assisting the PKK through their loans and credits. So this is almost the worst accusation that you can make in Turkey. So in the first 6 months, I was sort of a political outcast, and it took me about 9 months until I got my first chance to have a courtesy call in Parliament. So the second panel focuses on the elections. All the political parties are in election mode already. We have an upcoming election marathon in Turkey. The first crucial elections will be at the end of March, the local elections. But the implications of these elections go, I think, far beyond the local elections. Then we have presidential elections in August and also parliamentary elections now scheduled for next year, but they may also be brought forward. Who knows? The question of the second panel is elections in Turkey. What is at stake for Europe and the US? I think the short answer would be quite a lot. But the long answer will be given to you by our distinguished panelists. For the sake of time, I think I will not introduce them at length because you have all their CVs in a printed form in front of you. And we have agreed that we will start with Professor Metin Heper from Bilkent University in Ankara. And he is a very distinguished professor in Turkey. He is sort of a doyen of political scientists there. And he has spent a lot of time in the United States. On our long flight from Ankara to Washington, he mentioned that he has been taking his plane around, 50 times. He has very strong transatlantic foundations. He has been associated with the top universities in the United States. And without further ado, I would like to pass on the microphone to Professor Heper. And what we, I think, try to get at the end of this panel is some sort of clue how the election results will affect both the situation within Turkey, but also of Turkey vis-a-vis United States and Europe. You know, given all the internal political situation, the political turmoil we have heard already in the first session with the corruption scandal going on, and there's also the political war between the AKP and the Hizmet movement, and we had the Gezi protests, etc., etc. What will this have an effect on the upcoming elections, and thereafter also what is going to happen with the relations to US and EU? So would you like to make a first go, Professor?
Okay. Thank you for your generous introduction. My cup of tea is really Turkish domestic politics. So I may share with you some of my thoughts on the elections and what may be the implications of the election results on Turkish domestic politics. And I would leave the second part for my distinguished panelists. I think Justice and Development Party will be the victor in all of those three elections. in Turkey, people do not vote for a political party or a religiously oriented political party just because it's a religiously oriented political party. For instance, since 2002, two religiously oriented political parties competed at the elections, and one was, of course, the Felicity Party and the Justice and Development Party. Felicity Party does not hide that it is a religiously oriented political party. In the tradition of Erbakan years, to a great extent, although some things have changed. And Justice and Development Party considers itself a conservative democratic party, and to a great extent acts along those lines. Now, in the 2002, 2007, and 2011 elections, the Felicity Party has not obtained more than 3% of the votes, whereas the Justice and Development Party obtained first 34 point plus something, and then 46 point, and then 49.9 percent of the votes. Turkish electorate, I think, decides which party to vote on the basis of what the what that political or those political parties delivered while they were in office. And Justice and Development Party, in that regard, has a great advantage over the others, because Recep Tayyip Erdogan, for instance, acted as the head of the Istanbul Metropolitan Municipality, and during those years, he achieved quite a lot in Istanbul. So much so that we had a general election while he was the head of the Istanbul Metropolitan Municipality, and the votes of the Welfare Party, you see, in Istanbul, much more than the Turkey average. So he made a name for himself, and he continued to pay attention to what the people expect from governments, placed emphasis on the day-to-day needs of the people. And people have great affection for him, basically because Recep Tayyip Erdogan himself and others in the party really care for the people. They don't look down upon the people as some other political parties in Turkey do. And the even if they make some mistakes, I'm under the impression that the people in Turkey says, well, you know, what he's doing is not all that easy. He is under constant criticism from different quarters, and as I said, people on the street seems to think that he is trying to do everything he can for us. Erdogan has a great deal of charisma. I don't know to what extent these corruption claims will have an impact on the fortunes of the Justice and Development Party. But again, it is my guess that most of the electorate who had voted for the Justice and Development Party will not really change their minds. They also believe, I think, in the integrity of Recep Tayyip Erdogan. Now, of course, the question is, let us suppose that I am correct in this. the judgment of mine that that political party will be very successful at these elections. Of course, the next question is, will he become president of Turkey? And will there be the kinds of problems Turkey faced when Özal became president? Because Özal did not want to act as president only. He also wanted to have the last word on Turkish foreign policy, on some economic policies, and as a consequence of which there developed a friction between not the first prime minister, but the next prime minister, and Özal. Özal tried to call on the bureaucrats, had meetings with them at the presidential palace, and then he would come up with some policy suggestions. And of course, the prime minister very much resented that, so much so that the prime minister asked higher civil servants not to go up to presidential palace before taking a permission from him. And Özal was therefore not very happy with those developments. Now, Recep Tayyip Erdogan, you know, had been on top of things. He's a very intelligent person. I have watched him at close quarters. I had been on the science committee of TÜBİTAK, which is the executive committee, and there are these 6 monthly meetings. Ministers, undersecretaries, some rectors, and some representatives of the private sector, something like 70, 80 members meet. And he knows almost all of them by name. And he comes back from one meeting to another and, first of all, makes an extended evaluation of to what extent those policies which had been decided upon have been carried out. And on some other occasions, too, I've watched him, and he's, as I said, on top of things. So how can he be passive to a great extent when president is an open question? If Gül becomes prime minister, of course, Gül is also a prominent politician. Had been prime minister before, had been the foreign minister. I'm sure some problems will crop up, but let us wait and see.
Thank you very much, Professor. May we turn now to Dr. Gündül Tol? Probably it's not very necessary to introduce her to the audience because she is from Washington. She has been the founding director of the Center of Turkish Studies here, and she is also at the Middle East Institute. And may I ask you, perhaps, now you have touched upon the Prime Minister Erdogan, the AK Party, apparently there are reasons why the opposition is so weak, and what may be the reasons behind that. Perhaps you could also give some ideas other than what you would like to tell to the audience.
Sure. Let me start with... today I wanted to look at the elections from a foreign policy perspective and how the election results will have implications on both the U.S.'s regional policy and Turkey's regional policy, and then we can go back to domestic dynamics. So the title of the panel is Turkish Elections, What is at Stake for the U.S.? And I think first we have to answer this question, why is Turkey important? And why is Turkey relevant, and where does Turkey stand in Obama's regional policy? And I know in this town we're all familiar with the argument that Obama does not have a foreign policy paradigm. But I think still, especially the Libyan case and the Syrian civil war and the stance the Obama administration has taken on these issues have shown that Obama would like to, he likes to deal with foreign policy items on a case-by-case basis. But I think we can still draw some principles and get a framework, a general framework for the Obama administration's Middle East policy. And we all know that the pivot to Asia concept, Obama really didn't want to spend more time on diplomatic energy and resources on the Middle East. So that's why he wanted to focus less on the Middle East and shift to Asia. But everything happening in the region unfortunately prevented that. But that's been his vision, and he's against unilateral action. He would like to work with the allies, and he calls this leading from behind. So he doesn't want to be directly involved, and especially if there is no international consensus, regional consensus. He values soft power, and he, contrary to the Bush administration, hard power, he focuses less on hard power. And he doesn't have a democracy promotion agenda. And all these principles, I think, affect the two countries' relations and their relations vis-a-vis the regional affairs. So that's why I would like to look at the bilateral relations first. 2010, I think, was the most difficult year for U.S.-American relations. It was U.S.-Turkish relations. And the flotilla incident, of course, it was a blow to Turkish-U.S. relations. And then came the Iran vote in 2010 at the United Nations Security Council. And that was the year when we start seeing here in this town events titled, Who Lost Turkey? Is Turkey becoming another Islamist actor in the region? Is Turkey becoming another Iran in the region? So there was a harsh reaction by Washington against Turkey's foreign policy, especially vis-a-vis Iran and Israel. But then came the Arab Spring, and I think in a way the Arab Spring saved bilateral relations, because the American administration, I think, had this rational understanding of the limitations of Americans' role in the future of the region, because basically the revolution in Egypt destroyed the Camp David order and weakened and marginalized Americans' traditional allies, like Egypt, the Saudis, and Israel. So looking back to the principles of Obama, it would be really difficult without an ally to work in a region like the Middle East. So Turkey remained one of the very few very few countries that Americans could depend on. So that's why I think the Arab Spring initially strengthened the bilateral ties. But I think the Syrian crisis exposed the divergence of views of both countries on the Syrian in the region. First, Turks are quite frustrated with the Obama administration's reaction. I mean, Obama, he didn't really want to pursue a more forceful action in Syria, and instead of an outright regime change, Washington wanted a controlled transition in order to avoid the Iraqi scenario where all institutions were destroyed, and that led to chaos and the bitter civil war. So that's why Obama administration supported a controlled transition. And also, I think one of the main pillars of the Obama's Syria policy was to margin the fear of Al-Qaeda-related radical Islamist groups. So the Washington administration wanted to marginalize those groups. And Turkey, on the other hand, Turkey cannot really offer... Turkey has always promoted an outright regime, change in Syria. Because the Syrian crisis challenged Turkey's regional policy and it posed a domestic security challenge, it complicated its Kurdish question. So that's why, instead of a controlled transition, the AKP government supported this a regime change and turned a blind eye to weapons transfers from its territory to Al-Qaeda-related groups. And when Russia and Obama administration signed the chemical weapons deal, again, that was a blow, and that was for the AKP, that was the biggest disappointment. Because through the chemical weapons agreement, basically Americans engaged and legitimized the Bashar Assad regime. And also there were problems on other fronts too. With regard to Iraq, for instance, Turkey has been signing all these energy deals with the Kurdistan regional government, and it's been at odds with Maliki. And the Obama administration several times warned Turkey not to sign these independent agreements at the expense of Maliki, fearing that that could lead to instability in Iraq and also in Egypt too. Obama administration didn't really want to call the coup, Egyptian coup, a coup, and that was. And Turkey was, on the other hand, one of the very the strongest actor in the sense that it was against the Egyptian coup, and it really broke the ties with the new Egypt the administration. So that's why I think the Syrian crisis became the major problem in bilateral relations. But I think Turkey has come to an understanding that no matter what, even if Assad leaves power today, Syria is. It will take years for Syria to become a stable country that can control borders, and because of that, I think Turkey recalibrated its regional policy very recently. I mean, before it didn't really. Now I think it's closer. Turkey is closer to accepting a controlled transition. And with regard to Al-Qaeda-related groups, there are still media reports saying that Turkey has been, again, turning a blind eye to weapon transfers. But on the other hand, in the summer, Ahmet Davutoğlu, for the first time, he openly criticized these groups and made a statement that Turkey is against these groups and will do our best in order to control the weapons transfers. And the PYD leader also, he made several statements indicating that Turkey stopped supporting those groups. So on Syria, I think Turkey is now closer to Obama's approach. In Iraq, on the other hand, I think Turkey has been trying to engage Maliki more. And I don't think it will stop working closer with the KRG, especially on the energy field. But it's still trying to engage Maliki, which is a positive sign for Washington. And also, because of the Syria crisis, Turkey-Iran relations have been strained. But now Turkey has been, I think Turkey got the message that Iran is going to be in the picture, especially now the Obama administration has this Iran opening, and Turkey really doesn't want to be marginalized. So it's recently it's launched this initiative to mend fences with Iran. So today the picture is both Turkey and U.S. they see eye to eye on regional matters. But now the problem is Turkey is marginalized. I mean, the Syrian portfolio has been taken over by Saudis, so Turkey is not really. It's not an active player in the solution of the Syrian crisis. Saudis and Qataris, they've become much more active. And also with regard to Iran, before Turkey had that vision of playing the mediator role between Iran and Americans. But now that there is an Iran opening in Washington, again, Turkey is, I think, lost its influence. And leverage, and because of the stance Turkey has taken in Egypt against the coup, now the Turkey-Egypt relations are strained as well. So we are now seeing Turkey that is really marginalized in regional affairs, and on top of that, the political and economic instability within Turkey, I think, really destroys Turkey's image. But it not only destroys Turkey's image, but also Turkey has become a less valuable partner for the United States. And because of Obama's lack of freedom agenda, I think Obama administration hasn't really paid attention to what's been going on in Turkey democratically and economic instability. So I think that will be an important factor. I don't know if the Obama administration will change that stance. There's been calls for the administration to take a stance and to warn Turkey with regard to its democratization process, the Gezi protests, and what we've been seeing in Turkey most recently. That's a concern for Turkey's democratic consolidation. So I think this is what will happen. I mean, we still don't know, and I think maybe Dr. Hepper can say more on this. But this whole Gulen-AKP rift will certainly cost the AKP some votes. But I think it's really not realistically possible to know how much the AKP will lose on how much vote will the AKP lose after this this break with the Gulen movement. So I think it would be safe to assume that Prime Minister Erdogan is still. Is still powerful. The AKP is still a powerful political actor, and will probably lose some votes, but still will win elections. And I think what we have to discuss now is what would that mean, first for Turkey's democratization, and second for Turkey's role in the region, and third for Turkey-U.S. relations. We talked about the Turkish model a few years ago within the Arab Spring context, because Turkey has Turkey is a democratic country with a strong economy and a expanded soft power in the region. But if democratization process is in danger, then Turkey will keep being a marginalized player in the region, and that will have an impact on Turkey-U.S. bilateral ties. So I think right now we have to focus, and the Obama administration needs to focus on what has been happening internally in Turkey. So get rid of that Cold War mentality and just see Turkey as a regional ally, but focus on what's happening in Turkey, focus on Turkey's democratization, and then move forward with the regional agenda. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Gunnar Hanım, for your wide overview also of the regional dynamics, and I think it will also take part in the third panel. I would like to move on now to Associate Professor Murat Erdoğan from Hacettepe University. He is the director of the Migration and Politics Research Center at that university in Ankara. And he is not at all related to Prime Minister Recep Tayyip Erdoğan.
Not yet.
Or at least not yet. He will focus, in fact, on the Turkish elections and has prepared a short paper which he requested to read out. Mm-hmm. So may I ask you, please, in the coming, it's not more than 8 minutes, he told me.
Okay. Thank you very much. And first of all, sorry for my English. My first foreign language is German, and I have to read something. I think you have also the article. And I would like to speak about the Turkish elections. We have always the elections, and every elections is for us the most important elections. And we have also in this year two elections, first local elections and then for president. Turkey is a country which experiences tensions regularly due to both inside and outside factors. Has had historic elections since 1946. Some of these elections are called as turning point in the sense of democracy. Elections don't only happen between political parties, rather between politics and national will and state bureaucracy. For instance, 1950 elections has been a benchmark in Turkish politics by means of establishment of multi-party system and democratic environment. These elections keep its importance due to both the transfer of periphery to the center and the construction of the right-left statist nationalist politics. During this period, right conservatism, together with its stress on religions, adapted itself to the general profile of right. However, in Turkey, left had troubles in the adaptations of the universal left approach. Left conservatism had created its root around the nation of protecting republic with statist and modernist tradition. In such an environment, right conservative religions parties had opportunity to take periphery under their parties, and by doing so, they gained social democrat character. Enters of the bureaucracy to the 1950 elections, which brought periphery to the power, only lasted 10 years. State cannot be left to hands of ignorant nation, and the regime is at stake. After the 1961 constitution, elections became more vital. In these elections, people had to take place near the victim of coup d'etat, despite of all open-closed threats. Besides that, CHP, Republican People's Party, who had been called as the partner of the coup and the successors of it, had never gained power to be able to come to power after 1950. This situation has doubled the need of the state for controlling right conservative religions parties who came regularly to the power and represents periphery. Designed by 1961 constitution and taken under the absolute control of the state, Turkish politics has also carried the imminent burden, which is Cold War. The Cold War political confrontation were upgraded and the nation of the security gained high priority. Close cooperation with USA and NATO against communism was an important obstacle before the improvement of the democracy in Turkey. In between the years of 1970 to 1980, leftist movement in Turkey, and after 75, the Islamic movements, with their sympathy to Iran, has narrowed the movement arena of politics. There was a Turkey which terrified by democracy, human rights, and civil society, despite the fact that this has a wish to be westernized. After the 1980 coup d'etat, and the new constitution, Turkey had experienced a critical election in 1983. As a result of the election, Turgut Özal, who mentioned the liberal democracy and free market economy, come to the power. Due to his capacity to able to read the world politics, Turkey in between the years of 1983 and 1990 had an opening towards the world economy. In 1990 to 2000, Turkish politics had two vital elements that shaped the politics. First, EU politics in the country, in the sense that Turkey became integrated to the Europe politically, and second, Kurdish problem in the country, which at the same fastness and became an obstacle to this integration process. In 2000, this process changed its shape when the membership negotiation with EU started. The major election was in 2002, which brought AK Party, which is a one-year modern democrat Muslim party, to the power by taking the votes of periphery and liberals, eliminating all other parties in the country outside the power game. Normalization process in Turkey, starting with the lift of the political ban on Erdogan, lasted short. State had an suspicious judgments about the relation with EU and had a fear that this process could maintain the power of AK Party constant. There occurred serious sabotage in order to bring an end to the AK Party powers, AK Party's power, and at each time public prevent these by standing behind their party. In 2007, in order to take AK Party from the power, bureaucracy took a clear stand against them in presidential elections. However, this stand did not diminish the power of AK Party, rather it made the vote share of the party to 47%. In 2010, there existed a constitutional modification. 2011 election was an historic one in the sense that it meant that a party with the support of periphery and liberals come to absolute power with 49 vote share. Throughout the last 3 years, there excited serious negotiations under the roof of AK Party, since it was trying to be an ideological based party rather than a coalition party in the center. Moreover, depreciation of 11 years of power, Gezi protest, and then allegation of corruption made 2014 local elections gain an importance. What's more, it is importance doubled with the forthcoming presidential elections in the same year. All these above mentioned factors clearly indicate the importance of the local elections. If AK Party loses the elections in the cities of Ankara and Istanbul due to the events happened lately, it will bring to the party tension and courage to the opposition parties. In fact, there could not be a more appreciated time for the opposition parties due to anger of the public seen in the Gezi protests stemming from the violation of democracy, civil society, freedom, and their lives. In the sight of AK Party, this anger did really bother liberal democrat supporters of the AK Party. Nevertheless, thanks to the inability, weakness of the opposition parties and their lack at creating project, AK Party made these bad things to be forgotten in the society. Political charisma of Erdogan made the quick recovery of the party itself. Putting aside all these issues, corruption operations starting with December 17 is expected to affect tendency of the voters. Despite the efforts of the Erdogan, in which the broad pressure to the police and jurisdiction and opened the clear world to Cemaat or Hizmet Hareket, the corruption issue is expected to affect an elections. The effect might be seen in, for example, in Ankara, most probably. If the result of elections did not satisfy Erdogan, he might again give importance to the Western and EU politics. In the opposite scenario, with the victory of Erdogan, there will be the strongest identity-based politics in the outside on and in and outside the country. Despite the fact that new EU minister Mevlüt Çavuşoğlu has brought importance to the EU politics of the country, this process cannot be isolated from the attitude of Erdogan. It is good to remember that EU politics is the art of the Western politics of Turkish foreign policy, and the setback at this politics will necessarily affect the other West politics of the country. It can be said that the forthcoming election will play an important role for the relation with USA and also with Israel. In case of ideological-based party rather than a coalition party, Erdogan can take risk and become more confident in the relation with them. In case of opposite result, he would claim that due to conspiracy by USA and the others, he lost the elections. His attitude towards the U.S. ambassador during December 17 days gives the clue to this situation. AK Party, in this case of a loss in the elections, will be suspicious about the presidential elections. In the case Erdogan, by changed party code, will remain as a prime minister and president will remain as an AK Party candidate for presidential. Gül's West Europe-based foreign policy attitude will reflect the relations. The block of Erdogan over the jurisdiction prevents public from hearing news and made the party stronger by political means. That's why the attitude of the public cannot be shaped, and we cannot expect from public to be in healthy judgment level. If the process of December 17 had continued, the government might be in a huge loss situation. For now, it can be said that the effect of the corruption operation will be limited. The election will test the 12 years of power of a 13-year-old party with the lack of other factors. In this line, it is a real exam for them. This is 1 year process of election has the potential to reflect inevitability USA and EU relation directly. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Professor Erdogan, for this very, very broad overview and the outlook. And let's see what Professor Hüseyin Bağcı will say to that. What is his take on what is at stake for both Erdogan himself, his party, Turkey, and the relations to Europe and the U.S.? Professor Bağcı is the chair of the International Relations of Middle East Technical University. And he's just been re-elected for a second 3-year term, so congratulations on that, with 100% vote. He is in the process of making his department to the Mecca of Turkish-German relations. And I'm very grateful for that. I'm assisting him as much as I can from the side of the Konrad Adenauer Stiftung. And his will be the twin institute, like the American Institute of Contemporary German Studies here. It will be the Department of Contemporary Turkish German Studies in Ankara. So you have the floor.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Ladies and gentlemen, I have two difficulties. One, everyone is getting hungry slowly. The second one, I have to somehow give you food for thought, intellectual food. The second one, so many people before me have been speaking, so I have to find something new to tell you that nobody is falling asleep. But the fact is, however, I start with some analogies. First of all, we don't have yet any authorized biography about Tayyip Erdogan. We try to understand him of his behavior, of his statements, of his body language, but we don't have the psychology, what is behind his behavior, the way of thinking. So we have the authorized biography from Angela Merkel, as Stefan Cornelius was writing recently. I'm looking for that somebody is writing a biography of Tayyip Erdogan, not me. I'm wrong person. The second one is...
dangerous.
thank you for this dangerous. When Aznesin, one famous late Aznesin, was in the early 80s speaking in Paris, and in Turkey we had military coup d'etat, he was criticizing the military so strongly, because before him there were people from Argentina, from Brazil, they were also having these military dictatorships, and all these authors, intellectuals, when they were speaking, they damned the military dictatorship, they damned the system. And Aznesin was listening to them, and when he came to the podium, he thought, if everyone is criticizing the military, and if in my country also a military regime, so I have to say also something, some critical. And he started to criticize the military regime in that way that the eyes of these opponents of military regimes in Poland, in Argentina, in Brazil, getting broader and broader. After he was finishing, and he didn't understand why the people look at him like this. And they came, Aziz, why you have done this? Why you speak like this? So I criticized, like you criticized, your country's dictatorship, so I have done the same. They said, but Aziz, there is a difference. We stay in exile here, and you go back to Istanbul. So, thanks God, we are not so far. On Sunday, I will take the plane and go to Ankara. This is the first clue. Academic critic will come. The second one, this year I was talking to Turkish former President Demirel. It was on July 23rd. The guy is really very interesting, still functioning brilliantly. He had always said, those who understand Turkish and knows the Turkish mentality, like Helena Finn, they definitely know this. He said, dün dündür, bugün bugündür. Yesterday is yesterday, today is today. This type of statement does not mean anything for the European friends. They look very positively, logically, yesterday is true. Today is also true. But he said one more sentence, but tomorrow is another day. And now, this is the also for Tayyip Erdogan, tomorrow is another day. The third one, when Helen Macmillan, the former British Prime Minister, was asked, when he was Prime Minister, what he had to face mostly that he could not manage, he said, events, my dear, events. So no prime minister can control the events that they take place. The prime ministers only act after the events take place. It's exactly happening now in Turkey, and all the speakers have been mentioning this. The question is, how is going to manage this? John Locke, the classical liberal author, intellectual, was saying that the people have the liberty in democratic countries to deselect those who run them. Three times in Turkey, Tayyip Erdogan was winning the elections. The people have elected him more than nearly 50%. So he's legitimate. As last night we debated, the government in Turkey is legitimate. How the government is behaving is another thing. So from legitimacy to go into illegitimacy is a process. And I think we still have some way to go. Another point I will say, concerning Turkish Prime Minister and Turkish government, Machiavel was saying in his book, Prince, that a politician should have some conditions. He should be born on the right time. He has to know the right people, like Abramovich and all these people from America, you know, in the 90s. And then he had to be born in the right environment. He is very lucky because there is no... somebody who can challenge him. And the fourth one is very important. He should have fortuna, the chance, the fortune. I think Turkish Prime Minister Erdogan is the only Turkish Prime Minister, I'm teaching this, in our history who made so many mistakes and achieved positive results. There is no other example that somebody can make so many mistakes in the classical understanding but achieves positive results. So this is the beginning. But let me say one more thing from Süleyman Demirel in July. He said, he's, of course, the most experienced Turkish politician. He said, AKP came with the domestic and international conjuncture, and they will go with this domestic and international conjuncture. You have to be patient. And he added, to be patient does not mean that you lose the political fight. To be patient is a political process. In the long run, as the British were saying, in the long run, we are all dead. Now, I start my 10 minutes, I think, or 5 minutes. How many? Five? Okay. exactly 6th of October 2001, I was together with Fehmi Koru, Gündüz Aktan, late Gündüz Aktan, and Yaşar Yakış, the former foreign minister and founder of AKP. Three hands are fouls with Tayyip Erdoğan in the same room, and I was explaining to him just after September 11 events from foreign policy point of view where the world is going. As an academic, I can say he impressed me that he has taken a lot of notes, learned, and didn't say anything because he didn't understand anything from international politics. From this student, it's like in that time he was just undergrad, now is master of international and domestic politics in Turkish usta, or büyük usta. So the Turks are also good, like the Germans, to create words. It's important. So Tayyip Erdoğan has one advantage. He had an environment. Politically speaking, the people, the Turkish people, were fed up with the existing political parties, DYP, Motherlands Party, CHP at that time. And the Turkish people have elected this man with their votes to make him a future political leader. And he became one. The question is, how this personality is evolving is another question. But we, the Turks, we created this man. Like Tansu Çiller in the 90s. Tansu Çiller was the most expensive prime minister ever because we have been trying to teach her how to become prime minister. She didn't even know the Turkish names, the Turkish cities, etc. And this man is very lucky because he's coming from the people, from the street, if you want. His environment, his world understanding is that he is very close to the people. Never, ever before we had such a politician like him who is so close to people. And this made him a great man. I'm not talking here from these high-level intellectual discussions, whether he has studied 500 books or written 10 articles, or I don't know what. No, he is a political animal. And political animal means that somebody who has the instinct how to convince the people and is convincing the people when he speaks. President Gül is statesman. And I was telling this to Turkish President Gül on 24th of December 2008, before 10 days Egemen Bağış was appointed as Minister for European Affairs. I said, this is the political man, political animal, and you are the statesman. So you play bad guy and good guy, and good police and bad police. There are three men in Turkey who define and create the new Turkey. We are still talking about a new Turkey, and there is a new Turkey, whether we like it or not. The question is whether this new Turkey is going to be realized in the sense of the classical Western understanding, is another issue. But Tayyip Erdoğan is lucky again. He will be, if he is becoming president, he will be longer serving Turkish politician ever, even longer than Kemal Atatürk, who was president from 1923 to 1938. If he is becoming president, which is very likely, he will be until 2018, then in power and always giving the order. He is the only Turkish politician who has been never in the opposition, who has been always giving the instructions, and this is a very big mistake of his political career. Because to be in opposition is also a teaching process. So this is why at the moment he's very strongly criticized that he's always giving instructions, do that, get it, etc. So this is dictatorial or authoritarian tendencies. Nothing wrong in this sense, and I would say we have Allah Putin from Russian to Turkey. I'm not surprised because if you are having this legitimacy, what else you do? You want to modernize or change the country, and here Professor Metin Hepper has compared him with Turgut Özal in Turkey Inside. So this modernization concept is trying to modernize Turkey or change Turkey according to his world. Whether with this world we are good is another issue. This man is thinking in Islamic terms from the very beginning. He didn't lie to the Turkish people. We knew that he was speaking like this. Tayyip Erdoğan, Gül, Abdullah Gül, and Davutoğlu, they are like Olympic swimming team. They synchronized swimming team, you know, in the Olympic games. They make the same move, yeah? Three legs or six legs from three persons, huh? Getting down, doing like this. At the international level, never ever we got any different views between Prime Minister and President Gül. Exactly since yesterday, the question whether this internet law is going to be signed by Turkish president or not, I don't think so that the Turkish president can dare, I underline this, can dare to take any political position against Tayyip Erdoğan. So if Tayyip Erdoğan is getting becoming president, then we have the mayor of Istanbul, the prime minister of Turkey, and the president of Turkey in one person, which is called Tayyip Erdoğan. He is never going to leave Istanbul in his life, all the projects he is going to realize. Probably some of you would remember he was speaking in Argentina in front of the entire world. He said, and his wife and his children were staying there, and he said, I'm sorry for my family that I love Istanbul more than my family. This sentence has been said. You do not say it in a very European structure. If somebody says in Germany, you know, I love Berlin more than my family, in the evening we have troubles. the second point, important, I know time is running. Tayyip Erdoğan is very lucky person, again, because he does not have any political opponents like Süleyman Demirel, like Bülent Ecevit, like Necmettin Erbakan, who have been the master of Turkish politics. Who are those opposition people against him now? Kemal Kılıçdaroğlu, very lightweight, I mean, like peanuts for him. No problem. Whom you have? You have Devlet Bahçeli. At the end of the day, he's always supporting AKP policies. At the end of the day, never ever until today, he has been taking any, in the grand strategy of Turkey, any position against Tayyip Erdoğan. Now, this environment, of course, have been providing Tayyip Erdoğan that he is running the country as one man. And probably we are going to face this situation also in the future, provided that we are going to have a man or some men who have the same, in the sense of Max Weber, charisma, or in the sense of Machiavelli, fortune, or somebody coming from the people, speaking like the people, understanding them, and giving the impression that he cares for them. So this is very important. Sarıgül was one of the from the left side possible opposition. I have written this in Sabah newspaper, 2nd of April 2007. I said opposition needs a man like Tayyip Erdoğan. Otherwise, they will never come to power. A couple of weeks ago, in Turkish, we have this television, Halk TV. I was having 3.5 hours discussion there with Birgül Ayman Güler. I give also the name from CHP because it is already set. And I said, why don't you take Mustafa Sarıgül? Is the opposite of Tayyip Erdoğan in the leftist scenario. She said, no, no, no. I said, in the final analysis, you will take this man and you cannot escape the reality. What happened 6 weeks later is coming back with all this ceremony, and now is the candidate of AKP, of CHP in Istanbul. Now, last sentence. Tayyip Erdoğan is making religious politics, and nothing wrong with this. This man was, from the very beginning, thinking like this, and he was using all these democratic instruments in order to come to power and stay in power. The question is here not intellectual one. The question is here the people. The people, one man, one vote. You have to convince the people. My intellectual contribution for today, before the discussions, in Turkey, we are going to have a very interesting state of mind. The Turkish people say, first time in our history, we have somebody who is taking really like a father, who is doing so much world-class projects. Turkey changed in the last 10 years tremendously. And men on the street, ladies and gentlemen, they just think in very practical terms, whether they travel very fast, whether they get their food or coal, I don't know, whatever the government is providing. We have 8 million disabled persons, and never ever the state has been taking care about the disabled people like today. The result is Tayyip Erdoğan will remain elected if he continues this policy. He will become president if he wants. I lost a Chinese lunch to my dear friend in 2007. I said, he's going to become president. And the businessman said, no, no, he's not going to become president because he will stay as prime minister further. He has to do something. Thanks God, I have written an article that he stays in power if this English if clause was saving my academic career. I said, if he wants to become president, then he will become. This time, he will. There is no way out. Every Turkish citizen wants to become one day the president of the country. And politically, ethically, Tayyip Erdoğan, I think, has this right to become the president. If he wants, he will. Nobody can stop it, including myself. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Professor Bancu. I think you have got a very, very wide picture now what is happening in Turkey and different opinions, how the situation might evolve in the future. Probably there are a lot of questions. The organizers told me that we have about 15 more minutes until 12:15. So the floor is open for questions. And I think also Professor Hepper wanted to make another short statement. He said he has some interesting figures which are not known to the public yet. Perhaps he would like to give some statistics.
But we have only 15 minutes left, perhaps we should take some questions.
Okay.
Very quick question. I want to know what's post-Erdoğan. I think if we agree with the analysis I've heard, what does the next generation of Turkish leadership look like? I think a lot of us were hopeful at different points of time about the AKP and the youth movement and everything else. But today there seems to be a bit of pessimism around. So what does that next generation look like? When I look at Turkish students and the professors, the students that you teach, they're amazing. But then that middle level, there seems to be a gap. What is that a correct assessment or do you disagree with me?
Is this a question for me?
To whom?
Both professors, actually.
Okay.
I try not to make any predictions when it comes to Turkish politics. I mean, the what I said about Erdogan and the Justice and Development Party was an exception to that. Because in 1979, I was making a presentation at the Turkish House in New York City. Someone asked me a question whether the military will intervene in the future. I said, no, military will never intervene from this point onwards. And of course, some months later, the military intervened. And then I went to the same place to explain why the military had intervened. But late Walter Whiter, Baker, he was also around this. When this question was put to me, he was just passing by. I grabbed him by the arm and I said, Walter, why don't you explain to this gentleman why the military will not intervene? And he explained, quote unquote, why. And then a week, a year later, while I was now explaining why the military was in there, and Walter was sitting there. I don't know. I mean, people will take after Recep Tayyip Erdogan. Recep Tayyip Erdogan, as I pointed earlier, placed great emphasis on service. That was, of course, started with Özal, because Özal was the first senior politician who had said people should not serve the state, but the state should serve people. And from that onwards, some political parties like the Motherland Party and the Justice and Development Party is doing exactly that. And at the expense of repeating myself, the important thing is that the people think of Recep Tayyip Erdogan as one of them, you see, because he has great respect for people in general. So that's another factor, and perhaps if a political party emerges in Turkey and begins to act in that manner, at some point the Justice and Development Party would be removed from power. But under the circumstances, that's also rather difficult. When you look at the Turkish political history, when you have major political parties still active in politics, the founding of another party and that party becoming successful, we did not have anything of that sort in Turkey. So in the upcoming elections, perhaps, again, I hate to make predictions, but perhaps Justice and Development Party will lose some votes, but I guess those votes will not go to the Republicans People's Party. Some people may not vote, and if they are going to vote for a political party, the very likely political party getting those votes would be the Nationalist Action Party. You see, if I have 2 more minutes, I am now preparing to write another book on Turkish politics. A publisher had asked me to write a book on Turkish politics, something like, Islam, secularism, and democracy. And I said yes. But after a while, I start to ask myself, why should you write a book along those lines? There are several books. And probably what I shall do is, I shall come up with a grand summary of all those books, articles, including some some of my own works. By the way, I have an article on Recep Tayyip Erdogan. And I said, you know, I won't be making really any kind of a contribution, although the publisher, you know, would be would like, you know, to publish this book. Then one day, I started to think something about Turkish politics, particularly during the recent years. In Turkey, debating parties cannot manage to have a dialogical debate. In other words, they never learn from the debates. They are not engaged in debates, you know, with this attitude that perhaps I can learn something, you see. When you look at TV and on other occasions, nobody agrees with any of the points the other, you know, other debater has made. It seems to me, this is not, of course, true for everybody and each and every politician, but, you know, some politicians, some members of the media, civil society organizations, and so on and so forth, they have a normative mind at the expense of analytical and empirical. What I am trying to say is that many people in Turkey do not really care or careful whether or not what they know is true. They never check, you know, hearsay, and then they think, you know, it is true. And then they're also not interested why some things happened. So analytical is also missing. Therefore, in Turkey, what you see is the clash of, you know, ideologies, some values held very dear, and so on and so forth. And therefore, you know, people just fight at the end of those at the end of those debates. This is, I think, the major problem Turkish politics is really facing. So a new political party, this or that, as I said, this is the most major problem. We need to learn from debates too. Thank you.
Just 1 minute about the new generation.
1 minute, huh?
1 minute, 1 minute is second Davos, intellectual Davos, 1 minute. Yes, in Turkey there is a new generation. And in Turkey we have two parallel generations. One generation is educated still in the Western mind, understanding, with culture, music, etc. And we have the other generation in the last 20 years, in particular, it is in making already, who do not look to the world from more positivist perspective, but rather Islamist. Everything seen from the Islamic perspective, Islamic interpretation. We have two minds in Turkey, and these two minds will clash. The question is, how do we manage that these two minds are making cohabitation? This is very important, I would say. I have students, like many professors in Turkish universities. The women in particular, very important. The new generation of women, actually they want to live like a Western woman, but cannot live like Western woman because the parents, the brothers, this way of thinking prohibit to act in that way. And I'm sorry for those women in Turkey. And this is a big problem. In the 21st century, ladies and gentlemen, the biggest problem will be whether the women in Islamic countries will be freed. I'm not talking about emancipation. The question is to participate in the social life. Since 10 years, the main idea, state of mind, I must make this critic here very strongly of Tayyip Erdogan and his government. The women have been neglected. The women are sent into the kitchen. They are not taking participate in social life as it was the case before. This is the biggest danger ever the Turkish Republic is facing. Now, the question is how to change it. We know this. I mean, if the debate is going on like this in Turkey, the woman will define where Turkey is heading, not the man. And the woman should give their decisions by their own intellect, by their own decisions. Within 1 year, we had in Turkey 2,500 women killed. It is the biggest ever. And we talk on the one hand about these values. On the other hand, we see that the woman is facing every day such a big, I would say, unfortunate situation. The government should look to this also. And this is just a small contribution. Sorry, I speak too long, but anyway.
We have a couple of more questions. We will take them. However, let me just mention, talking about women, the AK Party's women branch is the second largest after China. They have 8.5 million members. And the AK Party is structured at the grassroots levels, and they are forming committees even to the apartment level. So I think, on the other hand, they are very, very well organized. The same with the youth branch. You mentioned the youth, Joshua. Also, the youth branch of the AKP is so strong, and I think they have now about almost close to 3 million members. So I think it's very difficult to beat them. They work a little bit like the CSU in Germany, the AK Partei, when it comes to the approach and how near they are to the people at the grassroots. But this is just a sideline. Yeah, we have two questions, sir. Yeah. You're first.
Stand up.
It's not the same.
My question relates to both the professor's comments. One could say that Prime Minister Erdogan represents, you know, a broader swath of society, classes of society that have become wealthier and become empowered by democracy, mainly in Anatolia. So my question is then the future of Kemalism, the term used for the reforms and the attitudes supported by the founder of the Republic, would you all say it was, you know, somewhat of an elite phenomenon or was deeply rooted, you know, within Turkish consciousness, more widely speaking? Thank you.
Can we take the second question, please? The mic.
Hi, I'm Meredith Morgan from American University, and my question is directed towards Drs. Hepper and Toll. I want to know, how has the Syrian crisis affected Turkey and its domestic stability, its border security, and the provisions it's having to provide for refugees?
This afternoon, you will get a lot about this. Yeah. The gentleman in front of you is going to answer this.
But in the afternoon.
Okay, very, very short one. Not Syria. Syria is going...
We have one more question here, the last question. Sure. I think then we have to close.
Okay.
Henry Hetker, researcher now. I wondered about the situation with the euro. Things are improving. A lot of Turks, from what the press had indicated, were really not too hot on joining the European Union recently due to the situation with the euro and its member nations and the problems that have been ensuing as a result. The other thing that I wondered about is a Turkish diplomat once told me that he wasn't too keen. This is like 10 years ago, that the European Union was not the answer in his book. They didn't feel the need to join it. Due to the fact there would be too much emigration from Turkey into Europe. They would actually be set back by the immigration policies in the European Union, the free movement of people from state to state. So I wondered, is there a need for emigration reform if this is such a serious situation?
Who would like to answer?
Very short, inshallah. Concerning Kemalism, Turkey is a project. A modernization project, and since 1923, Turkey has been achieving a lot. I do not expect that in the, at the end of the day that Tayyip Erdogan will be able to get off from Kemal Atatürk, but he has to live with him, wherever you look, the ghost of Atatürk is there, first of all, from the education to many others. The point is here, I would say, radical Islamist movements, at the moment, they have some difficulties. China, India, they support Turkish model of secularism. They are not interested that Turkey is getting more and more radical Islamist or Islamist state. So the reason is simple. China and India, they have a huge number of Muslims. Turkey has been a model for Islamic world in general, 57 countries, member of this organization. And Turkey has been considered the rising star to combine democracy and Islam together. That Turkey is negotiating with the European Union, it is a good thing. And this European Union was the most important external modernization factor for Turkish project. There is not any other country in the Islamic world which made the same experience in democracy like we have done since 1950. Despite all the difficulties, despite all the critics, we have achieved such a level. None of the Arab countries or any Islamic country can even achieve this in the next 5 to 10, 20 years. So we have this long experience, and it is good so, thanks to Kemal Atatürk. Whether Kemal Atatürk is forever there is another issue. The societies are changing. We are changing. So we have to look to the future. How to create an open society, democratic society, equality, gender equality, and of course, freedom of speech and thinking. So, is enough.
The last statement as to the Kemalism will come from Professor Hepburn.
Very briefly, Kemalism and Atatürkism are not the same things. Atatürk's Atatürkism is not the same thing, other people's Atatürkisms. We should all keep these things in mind. Atatürkism has been used for several different purposes. As far as I'm concerned, Atatürkism means that Atatürk told us how to think, not what to think. Mm-hmm. You know, we always miss this. So, you know, military interventions are made in the name of Atatürkism, and everybody tries to legitimate itself by making a reference to Atatürk. That's it. But as I said, we need to make several distinctions in order to understand Kemalism and Atatürkism. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Syria question. Do we have...
I think...
Please, last lady.
Also 1 minute, Yunilan.
2 minutes, 7 minutes.
Okay, I think Syria posed a challenge both domestically and regionally for Turkey. Domestically, there are social, political, economic implications. Socially, because of the refugees in Turkey, I think it's going to change Turkey's social fabric forever, especially in towns like Gaziantep, Mersin. And from a security perspective, because of Turkey's heavy involvement with the opposition and the problems with the borders, there have been infiltration of PKK members as well as radical Islamist movements, and that has posed a security challenge for Turkey. And also, I think sectarian tensions. There was the Syria crisis had implications on sectarian tensions. We saw that clash between Sunnis and Alevis on the border towns of Turkey, and also complicated Turkey's Kurdish question on the one hand, but on the other hand, it kind of pushed the government to launch the second PKK initiative because it has become an urgent matter for the government to handle the Kurdish issue because of what's been happening in Syria. And politically, I think it has weakened the AKP because there's been a lot of pressure on the government because of its Syria policy. And regionally, I think it has dealt a blow to Turkey's regional image. Turkey has been has expanded its soft power before the Syrian crisis, but now if you look at TESEV public opinion surveys in the region, Turkey has become marginalized at Turkey's perception. The region's perception of Turkey has changed. And also, Syria was Davutoğlu's test case for his zero problems policy. And I think it has dealt a blow to that. And I think economically Turkey lost as well, because Turkey had invested a lot in Syria before the Syrian crisis started. And Syria has been Turkey's gate to the rest of the Middle East. So I think in that sense it had both economic, political, and social implications for Turkey domestically and regionally.
Thank you very much. Thank you to all our panelists. It has been a wonderful session.